Chapter 34. To call you, so I murmured certainly, and Mr. Public Hook took me by both hands again, and communicated a movement to his waistcoat, which had an emotional appearance, though it was rather low down. My dear young friend, rely upon my doing my little all in your absence, by keeping the fact before the mind of Joseph. Joseph, said Mr. Public Hook, in the way of a compassionate adjuration. Joseph, Joseph, thereupon he shook his head and tapped it, expressing his sense of deficiency in Joseph. But my dear young friend, said Mr. Public Hook, you must be hungry, you must be exhausted. Be seated. Here is a chicken had round from the boar, here is a tongue had round from the boar, here's one or two little things had round from the boar, that I hope you may not despise. But do I, said Mr. Public Hook, getting up again the moment, after he had sat down, see afore me, him as I ever sported within his times of happy infancy? And may I, men mighty shake hands? I consented, and he was fervent, and then sat down again. Here is wine, said Mr. Public Hook. Let us drink, thanks to fortune, and may she ever pick out her favorites with equal judgment. And yet I cannot, said Mr. Public Hook, getting up again, see afore me one and likewise drink to one without again expressing may I, I said he might, and he shook hands with me again, and emptied his glass, and turned it upside down. I did the same, and if I had turned myself upside down before drinking, the wine could not have gone more direct to my head. Mr. Public Hook helped me to the liver wing, and to the best slice of tongue, none of those out of the way no thoroughfares of pork now, and took, comparatively speaking, no care of himself at all. Ah! Poultry, poultry! You little thought, said Mr. Public Hook, apostrophizing the fowl in the dish, when you was a young fledgling, what was in store for you. You little thought you was to be refreshment beneath this humble roof for one as call it a weakness, if you will, said Mr. Public Hook, getting up again, but may I, it began to be unnecessary to repeat the form of saying he might, so he did it at once. How he ever did it so often without wounding himself with my knife, I don't know. And your sister, he resumed, after a little steady eating, which had the honor of bringing you up by hand. It's a sad picture, to reflect that she's no longer equal to fully understanding the honor. I saw he was about to come at me again, and I stopped him. We'll drink her health, said one. Ah! Cried Mr. Public Hook, leaning back in his chair, quite flaccid with admiration, that's the way you know him, sir. I don't know who sir was, but he certainly was not I, and there was no third person present, that's the way you know the noble-minded, sir. Ever forgiving and ever affable. It might, said the servile Public Hook, putting down his untasted glass in a hurry, and getting up again, to a common person, have the appearance of repeating, but may I, when he had done it, he resumed his seat, and drank to my sister. Let us never be blind, said Mr. Public Hook, to her faults of temper, but it is to be hoped she meant well. At about this time, I began to observe that he was getting flushed in the face. As to myself, I felt all face, steeped in wine and smarting. I mentioned to Mr. Public Hook that I wished to have my new clothes sent to his house, and he was ecstatic on my so distinguishing him. I mentioned my reason for desiring to avoid observation in the village, and he lauded it to the skies. There was nobody but himself, he intimated, worthy of my confidence, and in short, mighty. Then he asked me tenderly if I remembered our boyish games at sums, and how we had gone together to have me bound apprentice, and, in effect, how he had ever been my favorite fancy and my chosen friend. If I had taken 10 times as many glasses of wine as I had, I should have known that he never had stood in that relation towards me, and should in my heart of hearts have repudiated the idea. Yet for all that, I remember feeling convinced that I had been much mistaken in him, and that he was a sensible, practical, good-hearted prime fellow. By degrees he fell to reposing such great confidence in me, as to ask my advice in reference to his own affairs. He mentioned that there was an opportunity for a great amalgamation and monopoly of the corn and seed trade on those premises, if enlarged, such as had never occurred before in that or any other neighborhood. What alone was wanting to the realization of a vast fortune, he considered to be more capital. Those were the two little words, more capital. Now it appeared to him, Public Hook, that if that capital were got into the business, through a sleeping partner, sir, which sleeping partner would have nothing to do but walk in, by self or deputy, whenever he pleased, and examine the books and walk in twice a year, and take his profits away in his pocket, to the tune of 50%. It appeared to him that that might be an opening for a young gentleman of spirit combined with property, which would be worthy of his attention. But what did I think? He had great confidence in my opinion, and what did I think? I gave it as my opinion. Wait a bit. The united vastness and distinctness of this view so struck him that he no longer asked if he might shake hands with me, but said he really must and did. We drank all the wine, and Mr. Public Hook pledged himself over and over again to keep Joseph up to the mark, I don't know what mark, and to render me efficient and constant service, I don't know what service. He also made known to me for the first time in my life, and certainly after having kept his secret wonderfully well, that he had always said of me, that boy is no common boy, and mark me, his fortune will be no common fortune. He said with a tearful smile that it was a singular thing to think of now, and I said so too. Finally, I went out into the air with a dim perception that there was something unwonted in the conduct of the sunshine, and found that I had slumberously got to the turnpike without having taken any account of the road. There, I was roused by Mr. Public Hook's hailing me. He was a long way down the sunny street, and was making expressive gestures for me to stop. I stopped, and he came up breathless. "No, my dear friend," said he, when he had recovered wind for speech. "Not if I can help it. This occasion shall not entirely pass without that affability on your part. May I, as an old friend and well-wisher? May I?" We shook hands for the 100th time at least, and he ordered a young carter out of my way with the greatest indignation. Then, he blessed me, and stood waving his hand to me until I had passed the crook in the road. And then I turned into a field, and had a long nap under a hedge, before I pursued my way home. I had scant luggage to take with me to London, for little of the little I possessed was adapted to my new station. But, I began packing that same afternoon, and wildly packed up things that I knew I should want next morning, in a fiction that there was not a moment to be lost. So, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday passed, and on Friday morning I went to Mr. Public Hook's to put on my new clothes and pay my visit to Miss Havisham. Mr. Public Hook's own room was given up to me to dress in, and was decorated with clean towels expressly for the event. My clothes were rather a disappointment, of course. Probably every new and eagerly expected garment ever put on since clothes came in fell a trifle short of the wearer's expectation. But after I had had my new suit on some half an hour, and had gone through an immensity of posturing with Mr. Public Hook's very limited dressing glass, in the futile endeavor to see my legs, it seemed to fit me better. It being market morning at a neighboring town some 10 miles off, Mr. Public Hook was not at home. I had not told him exactly when I meant to leave, and was not likely to shake hands with him again before departing. This was all as it should be, and I went out in my new array. Fearfully ashamed of having to pass the shopman, and suspicious after all that I was at a personal disadvantage, something like Joe's in his Sunday suit. I went circuitously to Miss Havisham's by all the back ways, and rang at the bell constrainedly, on account of the stiff long fingers of my gloves. Sarah Pocket came to the gate, and positively reeled back when she saw me so changed. her walnut shell countenance likewise turned from brown to green and yellow. "You?" said she. "You, good gracious! What do you want?" "I am going to London, Miss Pocket," said I, "and want to say goodbye to Miss Havisham." I was not expected, for she left me locked in the yard, while she went to ask if I were to be admitted. After a very short delay, she returned and took me up, staring at me all the way. Miss Havisham was taking exercise in the room with the long spread table, leaning on her crutched stick. The room was lighted as of yore, and at the sound of our entrance, she stopped and turned. She was then just abreast of the rotted bride cake. "Don't go, Sarah," she said. "Well, Pip?" "I start for London, Miss Havisham, tomorrow." I was exceedingly careful what I said, and I thought you would kindly not mind my taking leave of you. "This is a gay figure, Pip," said she, making her crutch stick play round me, as if she, the fairy godmother who had changed me, were bestowing the finishing gift. "I have come into such good fortune, since I saw you last, Miss Havisham," I murmured. "And I am so grateful for it, Miss Havisham." Eh, said she, looking at the discomfited and envious Sarah, with delight. "I have seen Mr. Jaggers. I have heard about it, Pip." "So you go tomorrow?" "Yes, Miss Havisham." "And you are adopted by a rich person?" "Yes, Miss Havisham." "Not named?" "No, Miss Havisham." "And Mr. Jaggers is made your guardian?" "Yes, Miss Havisham." She quite gloated on these questions and answers, so keen was her enjoyment of Sarah Pocket's jealous dismay. "Well," she went on, "you have a promising career before you. Be good, deserve it, and abide by Mr. Jaggers' instructions." She looked at me, and looked at Sarah, and Sarah's countenance wrung out of her watchful face a cruel smile. "Goodbye, Pip. You will always keep the name of Pip, you know." "Yes, Miss Havisham." "Goodbye, Pip." She stretched out her hand, and I went down on my knee, and put it to my lips. I had not considered how I should take leave of her. It came naturally to me at the moment to do this. She looked at Sarah Pocket with triumph in her weird eyes, and so I left my fairy godmother, with both her hands on her crutched stick, standing in the midst of the dimly lighted room beside the rotten bride cake that was hidden in cobwebs. Sarah Pocket conducted me down, as if I were a ghost who must be seen out. She could not get over my appearance, and was in the last degree confounded. I said, "Goodbye, Miss Pocket," but she merely stared, and did not seem collected enough to know that I had spoken. Clear of the house, I made the best of my way back to Pumblechook's, took off my new clothes, made them into a bundle, and went back home in my older dress, carrying it, to speak the truth, much more at my ease to, though I had the bundle to carry. And now, those 6 days which were to have run out so slowly, had run out fast and were gone, and tomorrow looked me in the face more steadily than I could look at it. As the 6 evenings had dwindled away, to 5, to 4, to 3, to 2, I had become more and more appreciative of the society of Joe and Biddy. On this last evening, I dressed myself out in my new clothes, for their delight, and sat in my splendor until bedtime. We had a hot supper on the occasion, graced by the inevitable roast fowl, and we had some flip to finish with. We were all very low, and none the higher for pretending to be in spirits. I was to leave our village at 5 in the morning, carrying my little hand portmanteau, and I had told Joe that I wished to walk away all alone. I am afraid, sore afraid, that this purpose originated in my sense of the contrast there would be between me and Joe if we went to the coach together. I had pretended with myself that there was nothing of this taint in the arrangement, but when I went up to my little room on this last night, I felt compelled to admit that it might be so, and had an impulse upon me to go down again and entreat Joe to walk with me in the morning. I did not. All night there were coaches in my broken sleep, going to wrong places instead of to London, and having in the traces, now dogs, now cats, now pigs, now men, never horses. fantastic failures of journeys occupied me until the day dawned and the birds were singing. Then, I got up and partly dressed, and sat at the window, to take a last look out, and in taking it fell asleep. Biddy was astir so early to get my breakfast, that, although I did not sleep at the window an hour, I smelt the smoke of the kitchen fire, when I started up with a terrible idea, that it must be late in the afternoon. But long after that, and long after I had heard the clinking of the teacups, and was quite ready, I wanted the resolution to go downstairs. After all, I remained up there, repeatedly unlocking and unstrapping my small portmanteau and locking and strapping it up again, until Biddy called to me that I was late. It was a hurried breakfast with no taste in it. I got up from the meal, saying with a sort of briskness, as if it had only just occurred to me, "Well, I suppose I must be off." And then I kissed my sister, who was laughing, and nodding and shaking in her usual chair, and kissed Biddy, and threw my arms around Joe's neck. Then I took up my little portmanteau and walked out. The last I saw of them was, when I presently heard a scuffle behind me, and looking back, saw Joe throwing an old shoe after me, and Biddy throwing another old shoe. I stopped then to wave my hat, and dear old Joe waved his strong right arm above his head, crying huskily, "Hoor!" And Biddy put her apron to her face. I walked away at a good pace, thinking it was easier to go than I had supposed it would be, and reflecting that it would never have done to have had an old shoe thrown after the coach, in sight of all the High Street. I whistled and made nothing of going. But the village was very peaceful and quiet, and the light mists were solemnly rising, as if to show me the world, and I had been so innocent and little there, and all beyond was so unknown and great, that in a moment with a strong heave and sob I broke into tears. It. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.